It's about billionaires, and it's about having the amount of money that makes you ungovernable. It makes you unregulatable.
I'm Polly Botsford. Welcome to this IBA podcast on what's wrong with English football club ownership and what the UK government might or might not be doing about that. In the most successful sports league in the world, the billionaire owners include a sovereign wealth fund from a country with an eye-watering human rights record, as well as US private equity houses. Elsewhere in English football, clubs go under because they can't compete. So has the UK government come to the rescue with its recent football governance proposals? I'm joined first by James Montague, journalist and prize-winning author. He wrote The Billionaire's Club, The Unstoppable Rise of Football's Super-Rich Owners, first published 2017, and is co-founder of slow journalism magazine, Delayed Gratification. In your book, you set out a pretty damning history of football's transformation from what you call the new masters of the universe that have now made football their business, from Russia, the US, Asia, and the Middle East. And we've sort of entered this era, which you call an era of private enrichment. And one of my favorite expressions is football clubs as entertainment products, a studio from a never-ending series. And we know that we all know from those 20 Premier League clubs, we've got a plethora of private equity owners from the US and businessmen, and two clubs are effectively owned by another country through their sovereign wealth funds. But where do we see this landing in terms of English football and ownership? What does it actually do to football itself and to the league?
On the face of it, it's a wonderful thing, right? I mean, it means more money comes into the game. It helps. It's kind of a self-perpetuating cycle, right? You've got all this money sloshing in. It means that it's whoever pays the most money, has the best wages, roughly speaking, kind of wins the most titles. It's kind of, there's a direct correlation between investment and success. So all this money sloshing in means that over the past 20 years, the English Premier League has become, from being kind of the sick man of Europe, into being the probably the most prestigious league in the world, the richest league in the world. It commands eye-watering domestic TV rights and international TV rights. For a business case, you know, this is a shining example of like global Britain, global England. Wonderful, right? Except that it's not wonderful, because what it's creating while having all this money kind of flowing into football is this stark inequality within English football. It's moving the game further and further away from its core fan base and from its roots, which is, you know, rooted as social institutions within a community for its supporters, and taking them into kind of global entities where that is kind of completely unmoored. And it's also creating a moral issue, whereas what we've seen in the past really kind of 15, 20 years is that super rich owners buying football clubs for all sorts of political ends, because ultimately English football clubs are literally the biggest billboards in the world. And it has attracted a kind of rogues gallery of some of the most morally dubious characters you could have, and states, whole states, which have appalling human rights records. We have a situation where we have, you know, gross inequality, because in a system like this, like in English society, the majority of the gains are effectively hoarded at the top, and there are crumbs that fall lower and lower down. And to try to kind of keep up with what's going on in the Premier League, clubs overextend themselves, they go out of business, clubs disappear. So we have this kind of pyramid, which we should be very, very proud of. And it's actually a huge selling point, but it's being destroyed by this kind of cash guzzling monster at the top that doesn't really want to share any of its wealth, thinks that it's the reason for its. I mean, you can make a case for that the Premier League, as in the body, the Premier League, have built this wonderful thing. They should get most of the benefit from it. But the cost of it is an extremely unequal game that is pricing out fans at, you know, its core demographic. It's two issues. It's what it's doing to the English game, and the moral issue about who's being attracted. And this isn't an issue about, I want to make this very clear in the book as well. This isn't like foreign, there's something wrong with foreign billionaires. It's nothing wrong with foreign billionaires as opposed to British billionaires, or British born billionaires, right? It's about billionaires, and it's about having the amount of money that makes you ungovernable. It makes you unregulatable.
What is it about the English system that's made it so vulnerable?
It's easier to buy a football club in England than it is in almost anywhere in the world, right? So if you go to Germany, it's almost impossible. Well, it's impossible to buy a club, right?
And you mean in terms of the sort of legal regulatory position?
Yeah, there's, you know, it pretty much as long as you, you know, haven't been, you know, found guilty of kind of fraud or, you know, I mean, I know they've toughened up the owners and directors test, which is what it's called now, to try and bring in, well, if you've committed a crime in another country, but you've not been, convicted of it, but you'd stand to trial for that in England, you'd probably be convicted of it. Which is a very subjective test, but ultimately, like, as long as there's nothing that you haven't already been in charge of a football club and made it go bankrupt or found that you've been dishonest in business, you can pretty much buy a football club. In Germany, you can't do that. They have a system which the fans and the clubs, a lot of them are, you know, viciously fighting to preserve 50+1, which keeps the ownership of most football clubs in the hands of kind of fans, well, kind of club associations, which are then dominated largely by fans. There are some exceptions of how people have got around that, but you can't go in and buy Bayern Munich. You know, we're a post-colonial fading economic power, desperate over the past 30 years to kind of counter the damage done by deindustrialization by selling off the family silver. And football clubs are exactly that. So it's kind of open season for all of it.
My next guest is Nick DeMarco, KC, barrister at Blackstone Chambers, and once referred to as the Lionel Messi of sports law. He has represented sports governing bodies, players such as Cristiano Ronaldo, as well as clubs. And perhaps most relevant to what we're talking about today, he represented Newcastle United in their battle with the Premier League over the club's buyout to the Saudi Arabian Investment Fund. Welcome, Nick.
Hello. Nice to be here.
James Montague has had a very damning take on this issue of club ownership and what he sees as a wave of ownership that's been bad for clubs, creates these inequalities. And the government has stepped up and has produced a white paper which introduces a new regulator, a governance code and a licensing system for all clubs to engage with. Is that going to really help us to sort out these problems?
I don't think it's going to solve the kind of wealth inequality problem, if we want to put it that way. I don't think it intends to try and solve that, not least because I can't see how the government could do that. And there's a real risk if you tried to do that in too blunt a fashion, you might end up destroying the success of English football. And the government certainly doesn't want to do that. And very few football fans would actually really want that. So I don't think that's what it's about. But on the other hand, we've seen some clubs, often smaller clubs, go into administration and some go out of business altogether. And one of the things the regulator seeks to do is to try and stop that. So it's at the extreme, so far as that's concerned. And also the European Super League, the attempt by some elite clubs in Europe and at one point the top six in England or what's historically been referred to as the top six, looking at a breakaway and steps to try and stop that are looked at by the regulator. So I think it's trying to stop the extremes of what may result from the kind of wealth inequality and arms race for promotion and so on that we have.
Perhaps we can just get a bit more granular about that. So in terms of that, those sort of touch points towards a more sort of stable league. How will the white paper do that, do you think?
There is some important stuff about fan consultation, but the two real important things that it looks at are financial regulation and owners and directors test. And those are the two key areas of commercial impact on clubs that affect all these things. And I think it's important to stress that the white paper, at least in terms of financial regulation, is very much soft touch regulation. It doesn't go half as far as the sort of financial fair play rules. You see that UEFA has, the Premier League has, the Football League has, or even the salary caps and more extreme end that the Football League tried to implement at one point. It doesn't go into that type of heavy financial regulation. It's more really about trying to make sure that clubs have proper processes in place to make sure that they are budgeting properly for their players' wages and other outgoings, the tax and so on, on a monthly basis. And so it's monitoring what the clubs are doing so that you can hopefully have an early warning signal if a club is likely to default in some way. And if you can try and stop that early, you may stop the clubs ending up in the Bury type situation where they went out of business. So it's really more about that, a reporting structure that sort of escalates depending on both the club's ability, but also the club's default, to try and focus on early potential breaches and prevent them.
I suppose if I think about James's rogues gallery of dubious and nefarious owners who were interested in sort of private enrichment, as he calls it, the owners and directors test, doesn't that really need some sort of some teeth? Don't we sort of need to take a bit of a stand on who we think can own our precious clubs?
Well, I'm never too sure about this because it's easy to say, but having represented a variety of owners, some of which may well be within anybody's rogues gallery, I have to say that by and large, however nefarious they may be drawn, they tend to put in a lot more money than they take out from clubs. And generally speaking, you know, it's like the old saying, if you want to make a million out of a football club, you start with a billion. Generally speaking, it's not, for most owners, a profit-making industry. And so I think we have to be a little bit careful about the criticism some owners get, because, you know, you might wish for a better owner and then you have someone who has less money and puts less in. And that's what's often happened with club takeovers. So I think the key things about the owners and directors test is it ought to be fair. It ought to be transparent. There ought to be better processes. And those are all things the white paper is looking at.
My final guest is Alex Phillips, a former Deloitte sports management consultant who then worked at UEFA and is now consulting to FIFA. Welcome, Alex.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
What other options have you sort of seen globally, perhaps in the US or in continental Europe, that you feel could really enhance the position here with the Premier League?
One criticism of this white paper is it's very financially focused. I mean, you have in our industry, if you want to call it an industry, you have money coming in, which is the financial side, revenues, and you have money going out, which basically mostly goes to the players because they're the stars of the show. The same thing in music, acting and other people industries, entertainment industries, if you like. So, but there's no aspect whatsoever of regulation of the playing side. So US sports, yes, they have salary caps, which actually work over there because it's one country. Over here, they don't really work so well. Look at rugby union in England, which has a salary cap, but it's also in a huge financial mess. What they do is regulate the playing side as well as the financial side. So they have player drafts. That's probably not implementable in Europe, but you can implement other things like such as squad caps, having a limit on the number of professional players. So there's one big Premier League club last season, according to the UEFA benchmarking report, they had 43 players out on loan around the world. So that's two separate squads, basically. So they have three entire squads. That means that all those players can't play for the competition, can't play for others. They're all monopolized, basically, where the money is. So rather than trying to implement salary caps, which we've already seen with financial fair play, that it hasn't been implemented properly. So it would be much easier to look at the other side, the playing side, and redistribute the talent in a different way to make sure that all those players who are sat on the bench, when you watch a really big team play, and there's now 12 substitutes sat on the bench in some competitions, that they could actually be playing somewhere else, that people could actually see them play rather than just sat on the bench or out on loan somewhere else. In terms of governance, you know, we can learn a lot from US sports. So an NFL owner, not just a director or an executive, an actual owner makes racist comments and the other owners kick him out. So you can no longer own a club. I mean, that is an ownership rule with teeth, which we don't have in European football.
Where's FIFA in all this? Where's UEFA in all this? I mean, when we're talking about ownership of this, you know, beautiful game, why don't our governing bodies just do something?
Actually, yeah, good question. They are, I would say, agnostic when it comes to national or local issues. So ownership is really a national issue, and in each country it's very different. So completely different. The legal frameworks are very different. Having said that, UEFA once upon a time, 18, 16 years ago, did have a document. You can probably still find it on the internet, a strategy where it said a vision 50 years from now, in an ideal world, all clubs would be owned by their fans. That was UEFA put that down, and it was approved by the UEFA Congress. So how did we start to try to implement that? Well, we set up Supporters Direct Europe, Football Supporters Europe, basically fan organizations, give them some funding so they can get organized, hold an annual meeting, have a staff member to organize, to try to build up knowledge about the different ownership models amongst clubs across different countries. And that they're still going. And, you know, they have made some progress, and they do provide a voice for fans that was never there before. So there has been some progress, but generally speaking, the international governing bodies don't take a position on ownership because it's a hornet's nest.